And so to Adelaide, Womadelaide, Adelaide, and the last of our discussions on our possible future. So it's Captain Kirk or Dr. Spock.
So here we have Tanya Ha, we have Tori Shepherd from Adelaide, and indeed Annabel Crabb is from Adelaide as well, but spends most of her time in New South Wales. Tanya Ha, who has starred on Catalyst on many an occasion, is responsible for the title about Captain Kirk and Dr. Spock. So to start off, what had you in mind?
Well, Star Trek for one thing. You know, nothing like a bit of Star Trek to get attention. And that kind of leads into the idea of Captain Kirk and Dr. Spock, is that the people we're trying to communicate with in the environment movement are people. They really like stories. And to give you a little bit of my history, yes, I've been a reporter for Catalyst, but that was kind of my dabble in journalism. I'm really a freelance mad greenie, and I've specialised in trying to communicate the need for behaviour change and the need for stronger policy through most of my career. And after many years of doing that, it's occurred to me that these messages aren't getting through. So I did what you do when you're a nerd. I went back to university and did a master's and tried to work out, you know, what are we getting wrong in our messaging? And this idea comes from psychology. There's a theory called the rational experiential self, or dual process models. And the basic idea is that we've got two quite different ways of processing information that helps us know what to do about it. Now, the experiential self, another name for it's kind of like the reptile brain, that acts really quickly. So if you see a snake, you run. If you see a problem, you do something really quickly about it. The rational self takes the information and thinks about it, makes decisions, gathers other evidence. It might think, you know, today's a really hot day in March. You know, we had a few hot days in March last year. Oh, I wonder if this is a trend. That's the rational self that's talking there, not the experiential self. The trouble is that it takes time to think through these things, and not that many people are good at that. Now, a nice quick way of describing the differences between that experiential kind of thinking is to say Captain Kirk. You know, he's someone who he'll pull out a gun and shoot the bad guy really quickly because he relies on his gut instinct. Some people, you know, who would call that feminine intuition if it was a woman. Men prefer guts to feminine intuition or emotions. But then there's also Dr. Spock, who he takes the information, he's the science brain, and you're kind of glad that he's there on the Starship Enterprise because everyone knows that he's the smart one. But at the end of the day, who is captain of the Starship Enterprise? It's Captain Kirk. And really, that's kind of the harsh reality for humanity, is that we tend to be more experiential than rational. This idea that humans are rational and that we will do the best thing for us, we know more than ever about our health, yet in Australia, we're more obese than we've ever been. We know more about climate and environment, and yet we've seen more environmental degradation than we have. So we don't necessarily need information to act well. Some of you might have been here yesterday and you heard from Simon Holmes, a court with wind turbine syndrome. To counter that, they put out a really good campaign called Act on Facts. But my gut instinct, my concern is that humans don't always act on facts. We respond to stories, we're emotional. And another, you know, alternative title we've seen for this talk is about, you know, the media and the merchants of doubt. The thing that I want to put forward to you guys, and that I hope we'll discuss a bit today, is that people who have a vested interest in denying climate change are better at that communication than a freelance mad greenie like myself. They appeal to that experiential self. Instead of talking about climate change information and statistics and numbers and graphs, I mean, you can't hug a graph. They present you with, here's a story of this family from Elizabeth. What would they do with the $500 that should be in their pocket because of carbon tax? The merchant doubts are better at appealing to our experiential emotional selves than we are in more scientific circles. And one thing that they're very good at doing is using the media to communicate that, and our politicians are very good at that too. So is that it in a nutshell? Have I used up my 7 minutes?
Indeed, you certainly have. But are you really expecting the CSIRO and the Met Office to appeal to the emotions? Because I can't think of anyone in those places who will respond in the same way as the other guys do.
Well, funny you should mention CSIRO, because I do happen to know that they have some research in Queensland that is looking at planning for peanut farmers. And they also do some social research. So they have some information. They know that there are farmers who are attached to their land in Queensland. Generation after generation has grown peanuts and they have to move because the rainfall patterns are changing. Now, that is an example of the real effects of climate change on real people. There's a story that could be told there. CSIRO aren't necessarily the storytellers, but they've got information that they can take to storytellers. And that's the kind of thing that's going to make climate change more real and digestible and understandable. And in this particular case, to a group, you know, farming communities, which sometimes can be, you know, more on the side of climate change skeptics than on people who are wanting to do something about it.
Tori Shepherd, the tension there between giving the correct information and maybe manipulating emotion, maybe telling a good story. Is that kind of tension you recognise?
Well, that's the kind of tension that makes for a good yarn. And, I mean, at the end of the day, that's what we're in the business of. And sometimes, you know, the next big report that comes out that shows, again, what we all know about climate change, you try and pitch that up against Kim Kardashian and, you know, all the pop culture crap that does loads of hits online, which is always a big problem because we have editors who can say, well, you can write that boring climate change report that says what we already knew. No one's going to click on that. They're going to go and have a look at Kim Kardashian's ass, because that's what people do
that's
when they go to
are.
The internet. So we do need to learn how to tell these stories better, and I completely agree with talking about the emotional side of things. Part of the problem is that with the internet, and I'm sure everyone knows about the issues that newspapers are running into, people go online to this echo chamber and look for people they already agree with. So I write opinion columns and thoroughly enjoy it, laugh at my own jokes. It's great fun. But the only people reading it and engaging with it are either people who already agree with me or who completely disagree, and then it very quickly devolves into the same conversation that we've already heard 1,000 times. So the next question then is, how do you actually change somebody's mind? I get hundreds of handwritten letters that, when they're not calling me butchhead barge ass, are just saying how either the evil hate media or the evil love media or whatever else I am. I've never had a letter that said, wow, you made me think about that in a fresh light and I've changed my mind and I now agree that climate change is happening. And that day, that would be better than a bloody Walkley. I tell you what, if you could actually convince someone to look at the science, to be rational about things, to move beyond the reptile brain, to move beyond this sort of beat up about the cost of living and so on, and actually go, you're right, we do need to do something. And I would love to learn how to do that. And I think then I would consider myself a good storyteller.
You don't feel pressures from, dare I say, upstairs to make you report in a certain way, maybe appeal more to the emotional side rather than the rational side?
No, I don't ever feel pressures from upstairs. Maybe they need the token lefty commie in the paper to keep that side of the readership.
You're a token righty today.
Oh, I know. It's hard being a lefty called Tory. I don't know. I never get the pressures. I don't know how other newspapers operate, but that's one of the questions that you get quite a lot. And I think there are big issues with the way that climate change is reported in the media. But you always get the brickbats, you never get the bouquets when it comes to reporting climate change. And part of that is just less conspiracy and more day-to-day newspaper, got to grab attention, got to be new, got to be fresh. And sometimes those big long-term issues, I guess, go to the back boiler a little bit.
Sure. Annabel Crabb, here is a problem that most of us would regard, not because we're group thinking, but because we read the scientific press and have done for some decades, as a clear and obvious problem. Now, I have this wild adolescent imagination that says,
where is this going?
That when you take our top politicians, be they in the state or be they in Canberra, they get clever people who understand exactly what's going on, briefing them and saying, yes, there is a problem, we have to face it, we have approximately 5 to 10 years, this is the risk, we must behave accordingly, we must bring the public alongside because it's going to happen. The physics is not left wing or right wing, it's kind of nature. So it's out there and we can't duck it. Am I living in a false paradise?
I love the way you think. One of the funniest remarks I ever heard Malcolm Turnbull make was when I was on a panel with him at I think it was a writers' festival or something with Laurie Oakes, Malcolm Turnbull and myself, and we weren't talking about climate, we were talking about something or other, and Laurie said that one of the most depressing things he'd ever heard in politics was Tony Abbott saying that he didn't think politicians should be held responsible for things that happen outside their own lifespans.
And
Malcolm, who was being typical Malcolm in that he was sort of interacting with this panel whilst also interacting with two devices on his desk in front of him, he was reading an essay on Roman architecture.
I've seen that, yeah.
I know that because I was looking over his shoulder going, you are hilarious. So he's going, Doric columns, And anyway, so he was sort of, I thought he wasn't really listening to Laurie, but he was because he heard the comment and then he said, he is incredibly fit though, isn't he? Which was the best. Malcolm is very, very funny. Anyway, it was a good moment. But, you know, there's a big question. Should politicians be responsible for what happens outside their own lifespans, outside their own political lifespans, which is a shorter time?
In other words, should they lead?
Well, this is the thing. Now, what you are saying is that you're assuming, and this is a good, reasonable and touching supposition, you suppose that politicians work and make decisions like Dr. Spock. And, you know, a lot of the time that does happen. There's a boundless and valuable public resource in the public sector that provides methodical information, research, advice. There's good advice coming from all over the place. And then you've got a group of people who are making decisions who are influenced not only by that advice but by other things, including senses of their own political mortality. And this is not just a kind of egotistic adventure that they're on necessarily. Sometimes you can only do good things or make big changes if you can survive long enough to make them, right? So that is a necessary part of the equation and not just a megalomaniac's indulgence, although sometimes there's an element of that too, right? So most political decision makers are hugely conscious of the feasibility of making difficult decisions. And what can possibly be more difficult than saying to a population, hey, I'm asking you to accept short-term hardship on my degree of ability to convince you that there will be a long-term gain. That is the absolute beating heart of advocacy, and that should be a politician's skill, right? But it's interfered with by a whole lot of other stuff. And, you know, the changes in the media are a massive part of this.
Because I can't help noticing that both Kevin Rudd and Barack Obama in the beginning said this is an urgent problem on which we must act.
Well,
they're not saying
it
now.
Have a look at the history of where politicians in Australia have been on climate change. So in 1997, Robert Hill, who was then the Environment Minister, went off to Kyoto and negotiated what the Howard government at the time trumpeted as an incredible deal for Australia. I mean, we were really able to pollute a lot more extensively than, you know, all of the other putative signatory nations. So, I mean, I don't think I'm over-egging the pudding to say that Robert Hill was borne home on the shoulders of his cabinet colleagues. You know, we've got this incredible deal. Where do we sign? And then, of course, Kyoto wasn't signed. It kind of went off the boil and off the boil and off the boil. And then it kind of left the agenda for that government and then became an agenda item again towards 2007 when there was an incredible kind of business and popular demand that something be done, which I think was entirely related to the drought, but, you know, that's just my pop psychology analysis. And then you had both parties in 2007 going to the electorate in the 2007 campaign with a carbon trading scheme on offer. And then the coalition post-Howard all fell into a bit of a worried little clump and argued about it and then burned through Brendan Nelson and then installed Malcolm Turnbull, who was on the point of signing an agreement for Rudd's emissions trading scheme. And then that was the closest that Australian politics got to a trading scheme. And then it all blew apart and it's the twain have never met since. So both sides of politics, I think, and you are all, of course, exhaustively aware of the backwards and forwards within the Labor Party on this issue. Both sides of politics have kind of changed their minds to a certain degree on this issue, and I think that is a confusing thing.
Yeah.
It interferes with our notion of what political leadership is all about. And the last thing I'll say, which is about the communications revolution, is that whereas the old pattern for communications, for any kind of policy reform, was politician decides what to do, media reports that, people pick up the paper and say, gracious me, I like that, I'll vote for that person again, or I don't like it, I'll remember that at the next election. I mean, that was kind of the simplified model. And now that we are capable of these miraculous degrees of multi-directional communication, we're all shouting at each other and we're all freaking each other out big time. I mean, now that we can discover to pinpoint detail what individuals think and how they respond, now that we know that they would often rather read, and I'm sorry, this is true, a Kim Kardashian ass story than Tory's very, very thoughtful column about climate change. Mm. I mean, that panics an already panicked media sector, which is wondering how it's going to survive. It panics politicians who go, shit, maybe nobody cares about this, and I thought that they did. I mean, there's a reason why politicians are hugely influenced by focus groups, which is where they get 12 people who have declared that they know nothing and don't care about what happens to ask what they should do now. I mean, that's a very odd place for us to be in, but that's nevertheless where we are. And it's because of our ability now to eavesdrop on the secret and honest thoughts of people that we're trying to influence. It's got us into a multi-directional tangle, I think.
Yeah, so it works. That's the problem. The short-term political strategy is scaring the crap out of people with the, this is going to cost you $500, so you can either do something about climate change, you can either have this long-term focus and suffer $500, and people take that short-term fix. It works. So we can blame the politicians all we like, but in the end, we voted them in. That's what we chose.
How much do these questions play a part in the South Australian election?
I haven't seen very much long-term talking in the South Australian election campaign at all. I think it's been one of the least interesting campaigns that we've ever seen.
Even though it's been 45 degrees, 47 degrees.
Exactly. People are too scared to touch it now. I mean, what Tony Abbott has done is had such devastating cut through talking about the carbon tax that he's helped throw doubt on the entire notion of climate change. And I think politicians are very easily spooked, and so they then start to steer clear of it altogether.
Tanya, would the new media have a different kind of impact now we're living in a
Definitely. And it could be for better or worse. I did some social research looking at mothers, because one thing we've found is with a lot of the environmentally friendly behaviours we want people to take up, a lot of them are habitual. And when you have something that interrupts habit, it's actually the prime time to create new habits. So I was researching the transition to motherhood to see whether that was a good opportunity, because I thought, well, when women have this reputation of becoming greener when they have kids, is it because they're thinking about the future of the planet? Maybe they've got more of a connection to health. And so that's what I researched last year. And the thing that I found fascinating as a side, like it was one of those unexpected outcomes that comes up when you're doing research, was what I found was the sources of information that new mothers are using. They're increasingly empowered to seek out their own experts, their own information online. And so if they've got a problem in the middle of the night, the baby's not settling and this, that and the other thing, they'll go and post a question on Facebook and get an answer straight away rather than waiting until the next maternal and child health appointment. And so that's something that I actually don't think government has come to terms with yet. I mean, it's another thing that Tory's written about is the vaccination debate. A lot of the information that has been passed between ordinary people is being passed via Facebook and completely bypassing traditional media. And that could be a force for good, could be a force for bad. And so I'm interested now in looking at new media and seeing, okay, how could that be used to help us with our climate change challenges?
Tory.
Well, people talk a lot about the democratisation of knowledge that you get on the internet, which is basically that there's a lot of people who go, well, it's been published, so therefore this blog by Joe Smith is of equal value to this blog by world-renowned scientists such and such. And so they place an equal value on whatever information they come across online. And this is a bit of a tangent, but the vaccination argument, the situation with vaccinations and people believing that it causes autism, is an excellent example of how really good science can get so easily subverted by the emotional argument, by worried parents going online and saying, my kid has autism, I don't know what to do, and very quickly finding, well, it was probably the vaccination, now I've got something to blame. And before you know it, the science is out the window. And part of that is a lack of science literacy from school, but also people have just lost their bullshit detectors. They really swim around on the internet, they read all kinds of crap, and so many people don't have the ability to tell fact from fiction anymore.
And what can we do about that?
Well,
as journalists, as public communicators?
Certainly education. We all know that science has gone a little bit off the boil. Education is part of it, but for the media, it is, again, communicating the science in a way that is compelling, in a way that hits both the rational and the emotional touch points, I think. And as I said, I don't think we've mastered that yet at all.
Annabelle, what do we do?
I think it's really easy to sort of worry about what happens to people when they congregate online. I mean, what this revolution has done is supercharge the elements of human behaviour, right? Because we are now getting a strong set of patterns about what people do. People do get freaked out about things. People do look for reasons that aren't necessarily true. People are incredibly subjective in the way that they approach things that happen around them, things that happen over there. They, of course, believe the guy who runs their corner shop more than they would believe their local MP. I mean, wouldn't you? I would. It's, you know, completely natural human experience, right? And what the internet does is give everybody who thinks a certain crazy thing an ability to get together and talk about it and to reinforce each other, which is exactly what happens in a village, but it's just that the village is massively bigger. So what's the solution to that? Well, innovation is the solution to that. Like, it's the solution to just about every problem. It is getting to be really good at communicating, getting to be really good at working out how to capture attention and how to deliver accurate information.
Okay, let me tell you why
time.
That's a problem, why it's difficult. And Dr. Spock comes in here. The scientists, people on campuses, are called the elite. The elite is a pejorative term. It's a nasty word now. It doesn't mean an excellent, informed person. It means a person who is disconnected from you, the ordinary person who has to work in Struggle Street, usually. And we're being told by people from a certain area that the scientists are no longer to be trusted because they have a particular angle. And some of them, maybe in climate, are all after grants. So there's more grants in telling everybody, getting people
climate
shits.
Change gravy train.
Exactly. Have you come across it?
No.
I reckon there'd be a lot of money if you could prove that climate change was bunkum. I think there'd be a Nobel Prize in that, and I think there'd be a lot of money, but they still haven't managed to do
Several Nobel Prizes, yeah. Annabelle, where does this elite stuff come from that says you are being lectured by people who've got a special kind of angle who are disconnected from your life?
This is kind of a battle of ideas, isn't it? There's a PR campaign going on every day. And if you feel you're being portrayed in an unfortunate way or an unfair way, then the only way to respond to that is to demonstrate that it's not true every day. And I think that it's difficult to expect scientists to be PR experts. It is, because if you spend...
Especially when they're not allowed to be.
Well, there are plenty of people who are good at it. I think that there are a lot of exciting science communicators who are alive to this situation. I think it's got to be an organized and structured plan of communication, I suppose. You can't expect people whose entire responsibility it is to do the scientific work to also moonlight as talk show guests or whatever. I mean, there are some that are fabulously able to do that, and they're great. But I mean, in the absence of that as a solution, then there has to be a kind of a communication structure, I suppose.
Yeah. And in a practical sense, there are a lot of scientists who aren't willing to talk to the media, and partly that's their own internal PR setups. But you'll ring people and say, I'm doing a story on climate change or on vaccination or on fluoride in the water and how it's controlling our brains, whatever it is. And they don't want a bar of it, because sometimes they feel that they're legitimising their opposition in a sense. And so they give up that space, that right of reply. So they won't go on Today Tonight, because that's not such a good brand look for them. And that comes back to communication again.
I don't want to get yelled at on Alan Jones is the other reason. Like, some of them are really...
Well, who would want to get yelled at by Alan Jones? It can be a horrible, horrible situation.
It's a rite of passage, I hear. There's one example that gives me great cause for hope that I think is delightful is the idea of citizen science. And I'll tell you a little bit about two things, because it is one area that Adelaide is actually really good at. But the example I have, I'm sorry, is from Tasmania. There's a program called REDMAP. And this started from UTAS and the marine and fisheries people there, and their research found that among commercial fishers, around about 80% was the combined total who were either out and out believed that climate change wasn't happening or were undecided, not too sure. So, but broadly, 80% didn't want to think or talk about climate change. Yet, what she found really unusual was that if she said, well, have you seen any of this particular species that's known as a warmer water fish? Have you noticed that off the shoreline of Tasmania? Like, oh, yeah, couldn't shut them up. These commercial fishers were talking about it till the cows came home. They had seen the evidence of warming oceans but hadn't realised it. And so Greta's the researcher. She set up REDMAP. The idea was to map species all sightings, and it invited recreational and commercial fishers and scuba divers to be citizen scientists.
And take photographs and send them in.
Send them in and then get these markings. So they're helping the scientists, but at the same time, what they found was that citizen scientists actually saw, met or interacted with, even if it's over the internet, with scientists for probably the first time in their lives and got an insight and a trust in the scientific process. Plus, the other bonus of this one was that the story, and that's the hard thing about climate change in the media, is you're telling the same story, it's gradually unfolding, yeah, the climate's warming, it's kind of boring day after day. But with Red Map, each sighting was a new photograph, a new thing, like, oh, here's a whale shark down the WA coast, 200 kilometres further south than it's ever been sighted before. There's the new story, there's the newsworthiness, but the underlying message is the climate's changing, it's affecting marine life. And I'm starting to see some of those citizen science type projects happening in farming communities, agricultural research, and that I've got hope for that. It's an innovation that might help overcome some of those
revolutionary
elitism.
It's revolutionary, happening like crazy.
That is an excellent example, and you're right about the newsworthiness. The question is, how do we do that in Adelaide, everywhere that we go? And again, the scientists, if they're not talking to us, sometimes I'll read a science journal, look at some research someone has done and gone, that would have been a cracker yarn, but now it's out there, it's been discussed, it's old news, and that is just the nature of a daily newspaper. So again, to have a place where the scientists could come together and talk more freely with the journalists. And here in Adelaide, we have the Oz Science Media Centre, who do a great job of bringing scientists and journalists together. But it needs to be broader than that, and it needs to be something that starts monopolising that online space to rebut and debunk wherever bad science is being talked about.
Yes, the Science Media Centre, by the way, I declare an interest. I'm deputy chair, and it's been based in Adelaide since the beginning for about 8 years. And when something breaks, if there's a plane crash, if there's a volcanic eruption or something like that, they then have two or three scientists responding to it. And this is for the mainstream media mainly, who need to react very, very quickly. And they can use those quotations, or they can follow up with the scientists or ask advice as to which other scientists there might be, and very, very quickly respond to what is a breaking story. Not necessarily for science journalists, although plenty of us make use of it as well. Partly, really, if you've got a climate change statement, like 2 weeks ago, Matt England accounted for the fact that there'd been a pause, supposedly, in the rise of temperatures, and he published a paper in one of the journals about, in fact, it was in Nature, about the fact it was the wind driving the heat, if you like, into the Pacific under the ocean, and this heat likely to come up again. So, okay, there might have been a pause, but it hasn't gone away. So you've got a number of stories coming out constantly, and from here in Adelaide and around the world in 8 different centres, the science media centres are responding to those sorts of things. And a journalist can check out very, very quickly whether a story is a beat up, whether it's got legs, or what to do about it next without telling them what to do. And I think it's very useful.
We get bloody good quotes. And I mean, that's the other side of things. Again, when you're telling a story, you can interview the top expert on this, and they're talking to you in jargon that not only do you not understand, but your readers have absolutely no chance of understanding. And I think, you know, the media probably cops a lot of flack for dumbing things down. But the fact is, we need to interpret these things, not put off an audience, but interpret things properly for an audience. And that means vibrant quotes. It means pictures of fish.
You know, one thing that I think is interesting about that is the Oz Science Media Centre has been great. And one thing that I would love to do with budget for them, if it ever came up, is that I'd like to see us take science journalism outside science. And I think this is where we have a frustration of seeing the same Ian Plimer and Bob Carter and the usual suspects when you're having a scientist put up against a climate scientist, that idea that for balance we have to tell both sides of the story. But I feel the public has been given a disservice here, because often in climate and environmental stories, it's not really both sides of the story. I'd like to see all sides of the story told, because there's a richness in what's happening in climate change. It's not just, here's this thing happening here in science. It's also, what are the consequences socially? What are the consequences economically for farming communities? And within there, if journalists need more than one opinion and they want someone other than the scientist, I think they could go to a richer depth of people, you know, talking heads, other than, oh, let's go to the usual suspect skeptic and deliver the counter view, however fringe it is.
Questions, right. Thank you.
Thinking about the behavioural change aspect and that we are responsible for climate change outside of our lifetime, is this a generational change and should climate change education be embedded across the national curriculum?
I have to admit, this gives me the irrits because everyone wants to sponsor climate change education and sustainability education in schools, and ministers sign off because they get really cute photo opportunities with really cute kids. We don't have the time to wait for the next generation to come through. But, you know, Gen Y, Gen X, that voting group, I think, are aware, and there's a bit of that generational tension with baby boomers happening there too. I think there's an element of that there. But one thing that I will mention, because it comes down to that behaviour change question of how do we get from information, from knowing these things, to actually doing something about it? And I don't have an answer as to how we go about it, but I think I know what we need, and it would be challenging for the media. You know, with psychology, when we hear scary stuff, we appraise whether or not it is a real threat. We also appraise our ability to cope with it. And Freud, he was famous for all sorts of things, but he outlined a whole heap of denial mechanisms that we go into, basically so we can sleep at night. So if someone has a high appraisal of the threat, this is scary, but a low appraisal of their ability to cope with it, then they look for anything that'll help them to sleep at night. And so I think that that's why we have such an appetite for denialism and people so willing to feed it. One thing that I think we could do in trying to bring about behaviour change is to show people that this is Australia. We're not a low-lying, poor Pacific Island. We actually have a whole lot of options. We've got great capacity to adapt and to do something to address climate change and to adapt to the climate change we can't avoid. I think we need to pair the scary stuff with a little bit of encouragement of we can actually do something, partly because we want people to act, but also because we don't want to send them running into the arms of the denialists out of fear.
Maybe you could, like, put a price on carbon or something that would encourage, you know, innovation and activity. Wouldn't that be good?
Like, yeah.
In America, Alan Alder is working with scientists to help them better communicate with the media to get their messages across. And he is using his notoriety to actually get the media more involved. Do you think we should actually use media figures like that to actually get past the deniers?
I was actually talking to Alan Alder about that last week, well, 2 weeks ago in Chicago. Lovely guy. And I have good news for you. We're already doing it. And again, via the Science Media Centre, they have a website which enables people to train, if you like, to deal with pesky journalists. And George Negus, a few other people, even I have been involved giving various hints about how you can best get your message across. Not manipulate it, but not be flustered by the urgency and, you know, those cameras pointing at you and all those pesky journalists thrusting microphones, but it's already happening. Anybody else want to add?
Look, I think personalities can be really useful. Have a look at Dr. Carl, for example. And before Dr. Carl, we had Carl Sagan, who was an amazing populariser of science, who made science kind of cool. And maybe it is a little bit too late to get to the next generation in terms of climate change, because we do need to start acting now. But anyone who can coherently put that message across, anyone who can talk about science in a convincing way, first of all, they're great for stories, great for yarns, good quotes, all that sort of stuff. And secondly, they are who people are listening to. They're not listening to, a lot of the time, the esoteric scientists in the ivory tower, not that I'm going to call them elite or anything like that. If there's someone people can connect to who can put that message out there coherently, it's always a good thing.
But Tori, how do you actually, as a viewer, as a listener, tell the difference between someone just picking various bits of evidence out of the sky and someone who is using kosher evidence, giving you a fair idea of what's going on? How are people going to tell the difference between what is a reasonable statement from a well-known so-called scientist or a bullshit artist?
Well, we're back to the bullshit detector, aren't we? And I don't know at what point that happens, where the taxpayer-funded bullshit detector gets posted out to everyone in Australia, but people need to learn to discern good information from bad information, and that goes for health, it goes for cancer cures, it goes for everything in your life. You need to work out what the good information is and what the bad information is, and the only way I can think of to do it for me is to be writing about it as much as I can, and then I run into that brick wall of I'm probably preaching to the converted. I'm not getting to the people who have the crazy ideas in their head.
Well, I tend to go and Google the name and check out whether there's a lobby group attached. You know, are they pushing a barrow or do they represent an outfit that actually looks at science in a fairly rigorous way? Another question.
Hi, I actually work in PR and worked on some of the trying to convincing people of the carbon price being a good thing. I just wanted to get your comments on whether or not you think that this push for trying to convince people of the science is the right move, or actually switching to thinking about the benefits on individual households of the money saving involved if you actually reduce your carbon emissions, or for small businesses. So instead of just trying to come at it from a convincing people to change their minds, actually responding positively to behaviours that could improve their own lifestyles and their own households.
That's really interesting, because the thing about public relations is, you know, the public is so diverse. There is no general public. For businesses, where there's a business case, and there is, for green buildings, for efficiency, then having good case studies championed by people who, you know, walk the talk in the business sector, there's definitely room in there. One thing that I find surprising about green buildings in particular is that they always talk about the money saved from reducing energy costs, but what they also find from research is that productivity improves because they're looking after indoor air quality. And that is tenfold a higher cost, a far higher cost from the people rather than energy efficiency. So the savings to be made by having a green building to look after your staff is huge, and that story needs to be told. With the money-saving side, and that's a bit tricky. It's different things for different audiences. Some people are going to resonate. That's going to resonate with them. But other groups, I mean, this is why I was researching mothers and what excites them, because I wanted to go for yuppie mothers. And what I found was that action framed around child health was what excited them. But the ones that I'm really after, those yuppie mums who have really high ecological footprints, they tend to view putting clothes on the line instead of using the clothes dryer. That's a bit povo. Like, they tend to view, there's research that shows that there's this kind of low status in conservation behaviours, unfortunately, in those groups. So with those kind of groups, we have to tailor it, understand the people we're dealing with first, and tailor it to what gets their interest. I mean, electricity pricing is all over the shop. There is so much that contributes to the cost of electricity. Carbon tax is one small one, but mainly it's poles and wires, you know, that sort of thing. So there's still infrastructure costs. Our electricity costs are still going to go up. And taking a really big picture, this is one of the things that I keep in the back of my mind about why I support renewables, is that while we've got our energy based on things like natural gas or coal, things that are commodities that can be exported, then we're relying on a commodity price. We're dependent on who's willing to pay what for that power source. So you look at countries like Brazil, China, India, all these growing economies, they're increasing their demand for oil, natural gas and coal as well. And what renewables offer us is independence from being taken on that roller coaster of commodity prices. So in the long term, I don't really think that our electricity prices are going to go down.
Another one over there, please.
Yesterday, we had a guy from, I think he's from Western Australia, but he's interested in getting a commercial wind farm going in Hepburn Springs in Victoria. Mm-hmm. And he is a businessman. Do you think there really is an opportunity for business to get behind these sort of cooperative green type energies?
Well, you're talking about Simon Holmes, a court, who, of course, his family does come from Western Australia. The wind farm is in Victoria.
Again, you run into this trouble of people cherry-picking stories and statistics and information, and you have a big fear out there about wind turbines. And Professor Simon Chapman has looked at it and found one of the things that best helps people overcome their fear of wind turbines is actually if they get paid to have one on their property. So business absolutely has a role in that. But again, the way that lobby groups get together whenever there are proposed wind farms cropping up, particularly in some of the smaller towns, they have to overcome some fairly serious obstacles, again, of bad science.
What do you think of the National Health and Medical Research Council, who reported
nothing to see here?
Yeah, they said there seemed to be no problem. And in fact, I think it was the 20th report of its kind to come out exonerating the wind farms.
And yet our peak medical and research council, they have to spend time and money again and again producing these reports that say the same thing. There is no evidence of any ill health effects from wind farms.
And so many other health issues that could do with research, including perhaps I might suggest the effects of the ash that's now falling on Morwell from the coal mine fires. That's Victorian bias here.
But isn't this what we're talking about, right? You know, people are people and they make up their minds based on all sorts of subjective data. And who's to look at somebody who lives next door to a wind farm who actually does feel awful all the time and say to them, hey, you know, hi, I'm so-and-so, I'm from Adelaide and I'm here to tell you that it's all in your head. That person actually, like, you're in a Spockian way, providing them with a written report as to why they don't feel dreadful. And that person's response is not ever, ever, ever going to be to say, thanks for helping me out with that. I now realise what a total dick brain I've been. Thank you very much. That person will go on an online forum and say, I can't believe what just happened to me, and find 50 other people who say, you are right, and that person is a lunatic. And that's effectively what we're talking about here.
Okay, Dr. Spock, how do you answer
that
one?
Yeah, and that, I'm actually talking to a lot of people who are in the wind industry saying, you've got to just show more compassion. I mean, you are so right. And this is what we're referring to here, potentially is an example of what's called the nocebo effect. So who's heard of the placebo effect? It's, you know, you expect to feel good, you do feel good. Turns out that if you expect to feel bad, if it's been spoken to you that, oh, you know, this happens and you get headaches and that sort of, we're quite suggestible, we can actually feel very real debilitating symptoms of ill health from it being suggested to us because we expect it. Actually, Jonica did a good story on that on Catalyst. But this could well be what's happening with wind turbine syndrome. And this is why all the noise around it, why the inquiry after inquiry, it actually makes me angry, because if I went up to a person who lived near a wind turbine and I punched them, I would rightly be charged with assault. But if you put information out there in the internet that encourages people's fears in a groundless way, fear is great when there's a reason to act on it, but when the fear is groundless, which may well be the case, I'm not an expert on wind turbines, so putting that disclaimer in there, but if people are creating these bad symptoms, they get off scot-free. And that's one of the things that I think, I don't know what we do about it, but there's got to be some ethics somewhere. These vested interests that are going out there encouraging people to feel sicker than they might not, or to attribute, the other thing that concerns me is, are there other underlying conditions that are causing the symptoms that aren't being treated because they're being told that it's because of something else? That's the other thing that concerns me too. But bottom line is, we have to have compassion. These people are feeling sick.
Annabelle, what would you say to that person?
I would say I have cancelled my plans to buy the property next door. Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I would say to that person. I think this is a completely diabolical human natural problem that is exacerbated by the technological environment in which we now find ourselves. The natural tendency of people to get together. I mean, read The Crucible. It's the best possible demonstration of this. The capacity for people to get together in small groups and reinforce each other's irrationalities is an ancient pattern. It's only really gone viral since it was able to through the internet. And so it's a diabolical problem. It really is. And I don't know what I would say to that person beyond, I'm really sorry to hear that you're feeling awful. That would be the first thing that I would say, because you have to remember, wherever you're dealing with anybody or millions of people at once, that each of those people, I mean, even the people that get routinely described as the deniers, now they all feel like a group of people who are routinely talked down to by scientists.
The elite.
Right? Yeah, sure, okay. So, and every time a group of people is ritually referred to as the denialists, it broadens that gap just as surely as referring to scientists as elites does. It's reductionist, and it probably makes a contribution to making people who are tending that way feel more firmly in that camp.
Hi, my name's Annabelle and I'm a fan of Annabelle's.
Right back at you, Annabelle.
I've had about a 30-year career in the biological sciences, and I'm currently studying communications and PR at the University of South Australia. So I'm very interested in this whole thing, especially things like climate change and the immunisation stuff. So what seems to happen is that scientists, the people who deny, it's like if you can be a journalist or a doctor or a plumber, but if you're a scientist, people have an opinion on your profession. So should there be a science watch like there's a media watch, perhaps, so people can understand that science is important?
That's an interesting idea. Yeah.
Frankly, I would prefer plumber watch. God, everything watch would be useful, wouldn't it? But there's already one called Checkout, isn't there? Yeah.
Checkout does that.
Science is pretty watched, I reckon. Science is a field where the commitment to peer review is unrivaled anywhere, as far as I know. That's a great discipline. The commitment to peer review in journalism is less robust, I think, it's fair to say.
People in general who deny climate change or whatever don't understand the process of science and whether more people need to understand. And it's not just science, it's any sort of academic research, I guess, peer reviews and things like that.
May I answer that?
As opposed to an opinion.
Sure, I'll then toss it to Tanya. The big crit that comes from a denial side, if you like, is that there's a consensus in science. Now, some people look at peer review and the consensus as some kind of echo chamber or conspiracy of the elite. What you should think of instead, and I broadcast something to do with Paul Willis, who's the director of the RIOS just here in Adelaide, and that is consilience. So if you'd imagine that there is a murder and everyone thinks the butler did it, and you go into the room and you look for 20 different sources of evidence, not one, but all sorts of different ones, the splash of blood on the walls, the knife, the personality of the butler. Maybe there's some other weapon there somewhere. Maybe there's a history. And you put all these separate pieces of evidence together about the movement of animals, about the physics of the sky, about the history of CO2, any number of things. And they all eventually, if the science is right, point in the same direction. So it is not a plebiscite where all these scientists back each other up because they're good chaps together. But there is a test from across the board. Tanya, would you agree?
Yeah. That was the shortest answer I've given, I think. The other thing that I think, you're right, people don't understand the process of science and the language of science. And I think one thing that I found when I was working on Catalyst, I was so used to the uncertainty that everyone's comfortable with in science circles that I would say to my husband, I might make myself a cup of coffee, when I was literally boiling the kettle and pouring it out. You know, I would never say I will make a cup, I might make it. Very comfortable with uncertainty. Some scientists are starting to use stronger language, but what I'm trying to do in some of my communication is separate the already happened to the predicted and remind people that the already happened was once predicted as well. Has anyone played that game called Mastermind where you have these little coloured pegs and it's covered and then you... That is how I've described to my kids what science is. This is how science works, is that that coloured row of pegs, you've got the solution at the end and it's covered and you don't know what it is. But you put your guess in there and you get feedback in the form of white and black pegs. And based on that feedback, you come up with a new hypothesis and then you test it. You get more feedback. And the thing is that first one was the most correct hypothesis at the time. The next one, that one isn't kind of wrong or unhelpful. It led to the forming of the next hypothesis. And then as time goes by, you get hypotheses that match reality better. And the ultimate test is that when you test them, you get more of the pegs coming back as the feedback. So basically, we're pretty confident in science when it works. So our predictions for the kind of things we're seeing with climate change, the weather patterns, the extreme weather, are well within what was predicted. The hypotheses have worked. And that's an example that I've tried to show to people, to show why we're not uncomfortable with something that was predicted in the past being wrong. Because that's how science works. We're constantly evolving, coming up with better understandings of what happens around us, and we test it.
Yes. Dr. Spock versus Captain Kirk. Final 30 seconds, all you have time for, Tori?
Well, I'm going to walk out of here and try and be a bit more compassionate, because I have a tendency to write a column and want to call people dick brains, to be honest. And I'm going to try and be a little bit more understanding about the space that they're coming from in order to breach that gap that Annabelle spoke about.
Annabelle Crabb, 30 seconds.
And I'm going to buy a property next to a wind farm just to express the sincerity of my resolve.
Would you please thank Annabelle Crabb, Tori Shepherd and Tanya Ha. Thank you.
And that's our final Woe Madelaide discussion on our possible future. Next time, we shall start a special series called Roots to Riches, presented by yet another brilliant woman, Dr. Kathy Willis, first head of science at Kew Gardens. It canvasses everything you've ever cared about in botany, from classification to photosynthesis, to the spectacular role of Beatrix Potter and the future of GM. Roots to Riches on The Science Show for the next 4 weeks. And meanwhile, on RN from Australia, there's Tim Entwistle's series on Gardens to Match. That's 9 a.m. on Sundays. Production for The Science Show by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams.